family is not a personal-based institution. It's a community-based institution because you're more than one person. And normally before life, before cyberspace, was that you would find anything to be busy,
mm-hmm.
studying, talking, chatting. When I say chatting, I don't mean today's
yes.
chatting.
Yes.
We would sit outside our houses
yes.
and chat. We would go outside our homes and play games,
yes.
football or stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When I say games, I mean physical activities.
Yes.
Not the games that have become
yes.
mature and renowned
yes.
today. So these were the things that we used to do those times. And in those times, around 2000s, 2004, 3, if we had a phone, the phone was used only for two things. Calling and texting.
Yes.
And because texting would cost, you would text very less.
Yes.
But when the application arised, like the example of
yes,
MiG-33, when we see the applications like MiG-33 coming, where now it's telling you text
yes.
with no cost.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So what you needed to do is just buy a data of millibytes
yes.
or kilobytes or bytes. And then use that to chat. And it wouldn't cost anything.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from the data, it wouldn't cost you extra money.
Okay.
But for messaging, every message that you yes. send, it would cost you money.
So it would not make people and the family members very much busy with themselves, isn't it?
So in those times, before
yes,
those
times, yes.
The cyberspace,
yes.
they were busy within themselves.
Uh-huh.
They would talk. Yeah. Now, because cyberspace is directly connected to internet,
yes.
so those times, instead of people watching YouTube like we do today,
mm-hmm.
those times people used to watch televisions.
Televisions, that's
the
right.
The round ones.
Round one, okay.
Of which they would spend most of the time watching that
mm-hmm.
because of the interaction that they had.
Okay.
But still, it was a family product. So
mm-hmm.
Even if the father was watching TV, in those times, when the father is sitting down, you see the mother and the kids sitting down together and enjoying the entertainment together. But now, it's not like that. So this is pre-cyberspace order. Now, post-cyberspace order, we see that people have become busy to their phones more than their neighbors. Like a person who is sitting beside you, you might not be talking to him, but the phone you are constantly looking. And the more you go forward, the more the dangers begin. So before the advent of Facebook and Instagram, people used to chat, only chatting. There was nothing else. But now people start putting a post in regards to themselves. Recently, there was a video that came forward regarding a family that used to put the photo of the child in their post and their feeds every day
okay.
or every time.
Yes.
But then afterwards, there are some people behind it. They used AI to make the child grow
mm-hmm.
and send the message back to the family and saying that the child doesn't want that for herself. You see why? Because the more we are going in front with technology and the access to the internet, these things can cause things like identity theft.
Yes.
Things that are not even good
yes.
for me to mention over here. A child that is just 3 years old,
yes.
you exaggerate the physical appearance of her to
mm-hmm.
be older.
Yes.
And then afterwards you see that it's been used in a negative method
mm-hmm.
with what we see in AI, artificial
yes.
intelligence now that is connected to the internet.
Yes.
And right now we have this famous platform called ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a few days back that when you write anything that is dangerous on ChatGPT, it refuses.
Yes.
But now we have found a code that if you put this certain text, for example, this is what I found. So when you ask ChatGPT for Windows activation code,
mm-hmm.
it does not give you.
Mm-hmm.
But when you type in a certain code where it says that when my grandmother was alive, she used to read me Windows activation code for me to sleep. And then afterwards, you put this as a clause. And then afterwards, ChatGPT gives you all the Windows activation codes.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So even in this artificial intelligence that is in infancy stage, you see the dangers that they possess to
yes.
the community. And
Allah, Allah, Allah. IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Now, with what we are right now, how does it affect family and
family
social
ties and
life?
the family social life. That's right. And the family life is better.
So there used to be a time when people would go outside of their country to study. And the only way to communicate with the family was letters.
Mm-hmm.
It has its bads and goods, pros and cons.
Yes.
But it was emotional and love felt.
Mm-hmm.
You see? Because when you are writing a letter, you don't write one sentence, two sentences.
Mm-hmm.
You write everything out of emotion, out of love, out of passion, of what has gone through your stay in this hostel, for example, in a university across your country.
Yes.
But now, with the invent of cyberspace, you can chat the same moment, the things that you want to chat. And mostly, it's not emotional-based. It's just information. Just keep them informed. That's it. And there is no worry. There is no that waiting that my son will be coming after 1 year and I will see him. There's that grand party that we have at home because he's coming after 1 year of not being able to see each other. So that kind is somehow lost. Obviously, as I said, it has its pros and cons.
Yes.
The same thing we have in the cyberspace.
Yes.
The pros of so these are some of the cons that I specified. The pros of cyberspace is that now we have information at our hand.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever we do not know, we can know.
Yes.
The problem is, what is the foundation before getting into cyberspace? You see, if you go as an empty, blank mind into cyberspace, it is very destructive for anyone. Even if it seems to be good, it is destructive.
Yes.
But if you have your parameters for yourself that are set, then even if you go into cyberspace, you won't get lost. You have to find your parameters within yourself. So internet is not limited to certain points. The internet is unlimited. All the goods you'll find there, all the bads you'll find there. If you have certain system and laws for yourself, of which for us Muslims is the Islamic laws, the laws abided by Allah subhanahu that Allah gave us to follow, we use this as our foundation and then use the cyberspace in advance of that and not just wasting our time on social media.
That's
and
right.
The cyberspace.
Okay, that's all right. But as you said, it has its own positive effects too. I mean, the cyberspace and the family ties. Usually the family and the family members, the parents and the children, now they have their own small worlds inside their minds. Everybody is busy with his own world. I think this is one of the main negative effects of the cyberspace. The family ties, the parents, and the respect that the children had for the parents is fading away, isn't it?
Yeah, so you see them spending most of the time on screens.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, if you try to get a statistic, you will find a child that is just born around 6 months.
Yes.
You will see that the child himself is too much attracted to colors that he does not know that it is bad or good for him.
Mm-hmm.
From that age till someone who is 90 years old, of which for a child that is 6 months, he is enjoying the sound and the color.
Yes.
But for a person who is 90 years old, whatever he listens become misdak, becomes something that is reality.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So, for example, we have seen some issues that were spread through cyberspace in regards to feminist movements or transgenderism. You see that anyone, because for example right now they say, if you follow this transgender information, then you are at the top.
Yes.
If you don't follow, then you are degressive, you are not progressing.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they use this kind of words to manipulate people. And when you see, especially the elders who don't normally work on logic and this kind of thing, they are mostly emotional and sensible people. So when you bring this kind of message that you are below the rate of a person, for example, we have grades, you are the third class grade. Why? Because you are not following the world right now. Yes. And if you see every person, whether it's atheist, whether it's transgender issue, they always say that right now this is hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow it, you are progressing. If you are not following, you are regressing.
Okay.
Now, a person without foundation normally will get lost and use it to disadvantage.
Okay. Thank you much, Brother Sohail. That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Sohail. May Allah hasten the reappearance of his final hujjah, his argument on earth, Imam As, inshallah. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page, to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran li Ali وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
A walk towards a perfect world. Part 1.
In the merciless heat of Iraq, a Muslim-majority country that has been victim to various sorts of imperialism, and has suffered several years of war and grave economic conditions. Tens of millions of people gather annually in one location.
Quite amazing, to be honest. I have literally no words for it, but it was really amazing, really. I have no words for it.
When I came for the first time, 3-day walk, it just left its steps in my heart. So I wanted to do the walk again.
I didn't feel like that I'm walking. I felt like I'm going to meet Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
We often speak about Tawheed. It's easy for me to lecture about Tawheed, but to live Tawheed and to breathe Tawheed, this is something that I've only seen in Arba'in. These emotions and these experiences are so, so, so exalted and elevated. You just have to come here yourself and experience them.
Media reports say more than 17 to 20 million people attend this walk each year. Even the lowest estimates reported by official sources are more than 5 times the number of people who perform Hajj in Mecca. But why? Why do millions of people from all over the world gather in a country that is often said to have extreme security risks? This is why. It is the love of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the last prophet of Islam, that keeps people going on this journey known as the Arba'in Walk. Imam Hussein's shrine is their destination. Arba'in literally means 40 in Arabic, marking the 40th day after Imam Hussein was martyred, over 1,200 years ago.
When somebody's heart is broken several times and they lose everything, but over 1,200 years later, their love continues to flow and their heart continues to beat within the Ummah of Rasulullah, and they're still shining a ray of light upon us, mere mortals, it just goes to show that Allah truly has preserved the Imams and their traditions, and we need to do more as Muslims to dialogue, to discuss, and to share our stories, because these stories are the definitions of our Islamic traditions.
Although Imam Hussein's status is greater in the Shia Islamic school of thought, he is also greatly valued by many Sunni Muslims.
So I've been with the Shia community for a long time. So, but not being a Shia, not calling myself a Shia, or not even so, it's just not about that, to be honest. But it just you know, if I would say, it's a God-gifted thing that if you have a love for Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam in your heart, the true love for Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So if you have a true love for Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, it just gets you. It's just like, you know, magnetic type of thing. It'll take you towards them. So this is what I feel. So I mean, I had the love for them. So this is why everything is getting open for me. So when the more love I have in my heart, the more love is coming in my heart, the more, I mean, getting closer. So this is how I like found out. But this one, the first time Arbaeen, to be honest, if I even go out now again, if anybody asks me, I would literally tell them to please come. Just for once, you just guys come and have a look. That the love for Imam Hussain alayhi salam is not just for the Shia peoples, not just for Shia community, it's for everybody.
It's really important for me to make it quite clear that those who come under the branch of Ahlul Thunnah, from the Asha'ira, from those who call themselves the Maturidiyya, the Atariya, those who call themselves Sunni, you cannot be Sunni without a love for Ahlul Bayt.
Like Maulana Sahib said, I was listening, that it's for everybody, every Muslim being. It's not the Imam Hussain alayhi salam, not for just for one person, it's for everybody. For every Muslim being, for every whole, basically whole world. So if you guys come and have a look and just feel the love and feel the, you know, because I think the love and then the peace and then the nice talk and the love the peoples give into this country, the way they welcome you, I think I never seen anywhere else in the world.
You can see the graves of the Maraji of Ahlul Sunnah, great Sayyids and thinkers, buried only a few feet away from the Imams. We went to the noble grave of Imam Musa al-Khadim, rahimullah. And this is a shrine that is holy to both Sunni and Shi'i. That there are scholars, Tabi'een, individuals who my teachers would speak of, who would sit in the same confines of that space and think and reflect and make tadabbur. And for me, to be sat in that same place, to be sat in that same place where the scholars of the past were, where the Ahlul Bayt were, where the last generations were, I'm not worthy. And then to sit with scholars who are so senior in their school of thought, and to be allowed, to be chosen, to be accepted to come here and to be trusted, is something that I'm still not able to fathom truly. And wallahi, for my own iman, I needed this trip. Wallahu al-Azim, I needed this trip. And I am eternally grateful.
Now the Arba'een walk starts from the city of Najaf to Karbala, around 80 kilometers in distance. It takes around 4 to 5 days to reach Karbala on foot, so it is definitely not possible to walk that long without some rest.
So I did a walk before as well with some other... not for this call, but in back home in Pakistan, but it wasn't for some different scenarios in the college or school, and then some other work experience as well. But this was like quite different. That when I feel when my sister, she said, like, there's going to be a 3-day walk as well. Will you be able to do it? And if you can't do it, you can take a taxi and go for it. If you feel like, if you can't walk it, then you can take a taxi. I said, we'll see. Let me go and we'll see. I was thinking it might be difficult for to be like walking, because I heard so many people like had blisters and some other things, like people get like ill as well. But luckily, I didn't get no blisters, nothing else. In the walk, because I'm just trying to tell you one of the experience. That I was on pole 1073, I think. Yeah, 1073. So when there is like there was a guy who was giving the massage, because everybody get tired and they get a massage. So but I went there, had a massage. So I feel like I asked another guy, do they accept hadiya? This guy said yes. So I pull out some money and they tried to give him hadiya. The guy left the massage and straight away said to me, please don't. We don't accept hadiya. I said, okay. I tried to give it to another guy. He goes, no, wallah, brother, it's only we doing for Imam Hussain alayhi salam. And there I put my hands up, said, no, I can't force them now. Because this is their love for Imam Hussain alayhi salam. And this is my love for Imam Hussain alayhi salam that I'm walking. But when I realized that back in the days, the people did walk from that place to that place. But we had so many, you know, comforts, like we have a massage, we have people that come in and give in water, they give in food.
From the start of the walk till the end, it is close to impossible for anyone to starve on this journey. As soon as the pilgrims start walking, they're met with volunteers offering refreshments, drinks, massages, places to rest and sleep. You'll even find tailors and people repairing all sorts of things, from bags and shoes to wheelchairs and strollers. In addition to these, pilgrims will also find medical camps in every few minutes of their journey, in case they need any medical attention. This one is run by volunteers from India, working tirelessly to serve the pilgrims.
When it comes to Karbala, you see utmost humanity among the people. You see people giving out food, giving out shelter. Just today, I saw people ironing the clothes of the Zawar in the street for free. Where in the world do you see such things happening for free? It just doesn't happen. It's impossible to find that kind of an environment, especially with this many people. There are tens of millions of people inside the city, and yet they're treating each other like a family. When was the last time that you saw a stranger and you just said, hey, here's some food. You want to sleep here? Sleep here. Do you need anything? Let me give you a massage. You must be tired. Where do you see that kind of behavior? Only here. In other parts of the world, in fact, even here in other times of the year, you're not going to see compassion between two people if they cannot even communicate. They speak completely different languages, for example. And yet here, you see people, even if they can't speak the same language, they'll be like, do you want this food? Hada. You know, they'll try to be safe. Let me give you something. Let me help you. What is this language that they're speaking? It's not Arabic, it's not Farsi, it's not English, it's not Urdu. It's the language of humanity. It's a language that you'll only find here in Karbala.
Iraq in recent years has seen the downfall of Saddam. Prior to that, it saw an 8-year war with Iran where Saddam dropped chemical weapons. Children until today are still being born with physical abnormalities off the back of the chemical weapons. After that, of course, came ISIS, Daesh. Sadly, Iraq has been through multiple stages of an ongoing war to completely decimate this country.
So, one of the things that I have to say I was pleasantly surprised to see was the unity among people. You do see an actualization of the verse of the Holy Quran where Allah says, وَاِعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا, where Allah says, you know, hold on to the rope of Allah altogether and be not disunited. Now, what is that rope of Allah? There are various interpretations amongst the ulama. One of them is that it is the Ahlul Bayt, and that's the beautiful thing that you see over here. Imam Hussein really brings people together. You'll see that these people who have almost nothing in common, they are very, very different people. Iraqis and Iranians, for example, very different people in very many different ways. I don't want to go into the details. But then you have lots of Pakistanis. On the same trip, you have lots of Indians. Pakistanis and Indians have a lot in common. And yet, you know, they have their differences. And then you have people coming from Sweden. I think I saw a Dutch flag. I saw people from Turkey. I saw people from Azerbaijan. All of these people, and obviously people who follow different marjas. And there are even people here who are not even Shia, are not even Muslim. And yet what happens? They're all united. Because the message of Imam Hussein is a message of unity. It is a message of humanity. And that is something that unites human beings in principle.
The existence of an annual walk with such a high number of participants from diverse backgrounds, not only walking together peacefully, but also being catered for by citizens of an economically poor country, in itself is a huge blow to world capitalism. It serves as an embarrassment to countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, who, despite having the world's largest economies, cannot handle their extreme poverty issues.
One misconception that might be there in the minds of some is regarding how these millions of people are being catered for, right? It's really, really significant that these millions of people who are coming and walking, right? No government is paying for their food. No government is paying for their accommodation. It's all people. People pay to come here. People travel to come here. People walk for months just to make this walk. They're not being paid by anyone. In fact, they'll pay out of their own pockets to be here and make this walk. Their hosts, the Iraqi people, they'll save up the entire year to give everything to the visitors of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Their country isn't in the best of situations.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
The slums are the source of blessings and not the palaces. A person is under the impression that his happiness lies in owning so many villages, having money deposited in banks, being so and so in trade. Perhaps this is what a person imagines. However, when we take notice and measure happiness, we see that those persons were happy that were dwelling in slums. Those that are in palaces are not happy. The amount of blessings that circulates around the world from the slums are not found at all in the palaces. We had a 4 to 5 person slum at the dawn of Islam, and that slum dweller was Fatima Zahra.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRB English Radio. About the subject of self-confidence, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, after trust in God, self-reliance is a source of pious deeds. This sentence we just listened to is about self-esteem in Islam. When describing the believers who will enjoy the greatest rewards of personal achievement, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says about them in this way, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم الذين صبروا على ربهم يتوكلون. Those who exercise patience and put their trust in their Lord. Surah Al-Ankabut, verse number 59. You see in this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is describing to us how to create confidence. Confidence is something that you have to build upon your reliance on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is a feeling of trust in one's abilities, qualities, and judgment. Once you realize that your main source of self-confidence is that you are a Muslim, then you can further develop your self-confidence. What Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh means by self-confidence is being aware of your limitations and areas of growth. No person is perfect, and we do have limitations. Being aware of yourself and your limitations is a big part of self-confidence because it helps you to know what you may and may not contribute to a situation. Being aware of your areas for growth can help you to start improving yourself. That is the point in the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, which is of high significance for us. Okay, now for ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh regarding self-confidence. Well, about that he said, after trust in God, self-reliance is a source of pious deeds. Thank you very much for being with us. Until another episode, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. This is Arabic English Radio, and you're listening to You Station. I am Bita.
And I'm Asma, once again.
If you are in our sweet, sweet home.
Yeah. Ever since we were kids, I am so sure that you have had the same experience. And the audiences, and guys, I'm just so sure that what I'm going to say is just the same story that has happened to many of you.
Yeah.
When I was a kiddo, we had this house of my grandparents. We went there, and then all the kids together. And then back in time, we were too much of kids, you know, not like right now.
Nice.
Just one, two, or three. No, we were like this bunch of kids together. And then I had some kids of my own age. Among them, there was a cousin of mine. She was just the same as my age, 1 year older than me. Now, the thing is that she was always on my nerve. How? Well, she started to show off even about the shoes she was wearing.
Come on.
At that age, right now, when I just look back and I just see her behavior, I say, what happens to a girl, to a six-year-old girl, to be that pompous?
Yeah. I know, because
how
I had
come?
This experience, and unfortunately I wasn't born in a kind of crowded family that there were a lot of kids. No, it wasn't like that. I was...
So you were like the other
generation. Yeah, the other side. I was the first kid in my family from both sides, my parents and my father and my mother. And for 8 years, there was no one around me. Yeah, I was an only child.
I don't know
child.
If it's a blessing or if it's
I don't know
not
either.
A blessing.
I don't know either. So, you know, I was a pure only child. Okay.
So only.
So lonely. And when I just went to school, it was kind of new world to me. Just a lot of people and my age, and I saw them. And there was a friend of mine, and she was always showing off about, I don't know, her siblings, her tablet, cell phone.
Yeah.
At that time, having a tablet was something kind of like a blessing, that not all the people and none of the kids have the chance to have a tablet.
Yeah.
And, you know, when she was like, okay, I'm so rich, and I traveled to that country, to this country, and, you know, it was meaningless for me at that age, whatever she was telling me. And I was like, maybe she is trying to catch my attention or something like that, because she wants me to be friends with her. But after a kind of long time, I just figured out that people are evaluating themselves by these kind of things, by showing off the things that they may not have.
Yeah, well,
and
you know,
this is the point.
Now we talked about the time when we were kids and teenagers. Just imagine, as we grew older and we came into society with older people, we saw that, okay, it does not cease to exist. It not only stops to exist, but also it starts to grow in another format.
Yeah.
Now you can see many grown-ups who just show off to each other. At the age of 40, I don't know, 50, 60, whatever age they have, they do not learn the fact that whatever you have, maybe it's a blessing, maybe it's a test, whatever that you have, is not just a thing that's going to be eternal for you. You're not going to take it with you to the grave.
And you know, sometimes showing off is not about the things that you have. It's about the things that you don't, but you wish for to have.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the inferiority complex that we have in just psychological aspects, and we talk about it, that you feel inferior, and because of this feeling inferior, you want to prove that you are superior to other people, to yourself.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is something really sad that I see, especially in some people on social medias. You know, this is something really common in social medias, that people show a picture of them themselves that they don't have, but they wish to have.
You actually are pointing at the very reasons of why people show up.
Yeah.
And it's very true. Sometimes it comes out of the lacks that you feel deep down. And it's very sad. So before we penetrate into some more reasons, let's go for a short break.
The
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Okay, so we're talking about this showing off things that people show off about the things that they don't have. I wish we could show off about the time that we have in Youth Station, but unfortunately this is the only thing that we always don't have, you know? Always talking about these beautiful things, and by the way, this is Youth Station. So
yes, and we're here talking about pompous people who show off all the time, and they are these hated people everywhere.
They are. But
nobody likes them.
But sometimes you feel pity for these people.
That of course. The first thing that gets into your mind is that, for example, when I see women feeling so happy about the gold or the piece of jewelry they have bought,
this is
and
foolish.
Then they start to show off in front of their,
yeah.
I don't know, in their communities, they start to just brag about the things they have. The first thing that gets into my mind is pity, because I just feel like there is something somewhere in her life that is missing, and she tries to fill that void with her love for the jewels or for the gold or for anything.
You know, actually we were counting some of the reasons of this behavior of showing off that I mentioned, this inferiority complex, and right now you told me just one of the reasons that you're trying to feel something. And whenever the point of view of your life is so materialistic, I think showing off is somehow more highlighted. Because you are expressing the values and the priorities of your life into things that they don't matter, but you put your value in that thing.
Exactly.
Things. Like the gold, like money. And unfortunately, the actually trend is going in that way.
Yeah.
That the more money you have and the more you're showing off the money you have, you're loved by other people.
Yeah, you are a much up-to-date person.
Exactly.
But that's not true. Well, the concepts have changed so much. The other reason I could mention is the shallowness of their brain. You know, some people really, really, really do not have a school of thought for themselves.
Yeah.
They go without thinking. I am really much sorry for saying that, but unfortunately, some people would just accept it for themselves, not to elevate themselves with new thoughts, new ideas, with growing up, learning new stuff, you know, because you see, among those friends who just show off to each other about the things they have studied, just imagine, they show off about the things they have learned recently. There are some other people who would show off about the things they have because they do not have any other thing to talk about.
Yeah.
You know?
I know what you mean. And another thing is that sometimes you are communicating with other people, the people that are not in as the same class as you are.
Yeah.
By class, I mean maybe financial class or social class. And you, and this lack of yours that you feel in your life is somehow more emphasized, more highlighted. And you try to be someone else.
Yeah, you try to bring yourself up to their level, and that would actually kill you, I suppose.
This is sad.
So sad, so depressing, and so annoying, but unfortunately we see a lot of it nowadays. There's a lot of it back in there. See, there are too many reasons for that, for people to start showing off. But then what's the cure?
I think curing these kind of people is really difficult. Because,
do you think such people would... I mean, as personally myself, usually when I look at them, I say, still my cousin is the same girl. She has not changed.
They won't change
easily. So from the age 6 that I just saw her more and more, up until now that we do not see each other, and we see each other just out of a blue moon, even right now, she feels the same girl. So when I just see her, I make sure that I just... It has become my belief after seeing her that there's no way for people to get cured out of this disease of showing off and bragging about the things they have.
Actually, it's a bit harsh to tell me that there is no way, but I have to admit that because, you know, I have a friend in university that she's always showing off everything. You know, she is somehow close to me and she tells me her difficulties and problems and so on. And once she told me something that was really interesting for me. She told me that I'm tired. of pretending whatever I'm not, always pretending I'm happy, yeah. always pretending I'm rich. She just told me that even I'm pretending for my parents. And it was really dark for me too.
Yeah. So there's another reason, depression. Yeah. Depression makes you go for showing off and boast about the things you have. So yes, we're still talking about pompous people in Youth Station. Well, maybe we have mentioned these guys a lot in Youth Station. Maybe there have been many topics that we brought them into those topics because, you know, these guys are being so conspicuous nowadays. They are very much dominant, you know, because they can show themselves everywhere. And there is this media which has made everything pretty easy for them. They do not have to see other people to just show off. They put the photos and the videos in their pages and then everything is done.
Exactly.
So they can get to what they want. And then they get the comments. They can get the crying of other people. I don't know if they would feel happy or not, but there's another reason for that, which is they show off by their things, which are materialistic, of course, and mostly, they use it as a sort of distraction. You know, they want to distract themselves from the real life they have, as in a remedy. They do not want to believe what they're living in, and then they use this method as a strategy to just fight against what they are living in reality.
And then after a time, you know, it will become their habit.
There is another aspect to this showing off. Back in time, or maybe even as in a religious aspect, from the religious point of view, people were showing off about the prayers they do.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And about the things they did. I mean, the charity stuff. We see that right now even. People pretend like they care for other people. They go for charity. But what happens actually behind the curtain is just the otherwise.
I know. And there are these kind of people that they're acting and pretending like, oh, I care about the poor people and the poor kids that are in the street. I don't know, the child labor. Mm-hmm. And I'm so thoughtful, as you see, you know. And I like that. And unfortunately, this is only a game for them.
Exactly.
To catch your attention, to have more attention. Yeah. Whenever someone is showing off for you, if you act like, oh my gosh, really, wow, or something like that, you are giving what they want. Okay.
Exactly.
So you have to stop it. Sometimes you have to, this is all you have in your life. This is all your life is. I don't know, showing off your car, your luxury car, your luxury life. Life is not all.
And trust me, you're not going to take it with you to the grave. The only thing that comes with you to the grave is your pure heart, is whatever goodness you have done to the entire humanity, is with the nice thinking that you have shared with other people. It is with the sparkles that you have shared in the world of human beings.
You know,
care that you have for them.
This actually pure heart that we see from other people is, again, showing off. So the intention really matters here.
Yeah,
you
the intention.
You have to be pure intentionally.
And it's pretty clear, you know, the one that has got a good intention is totally clear from the one who does not have, who's just showing off with it.
So
who's just trying to brag about it and boast about it while it does not exist. And something for the record, to gist it all up, I would say that there's this verse in the Holy Book of Quran that says, "Inna akramakum 'indallahi atqakum." That means the noblest of you before Allah is the most righteous of you. So there's nothing to brag about unless your good deeds that you have done in God's eyes, not for people. With good intention, just the way you just said it. So I guess that makes it all.
Yeah, and let me add this sentence that you have to have the attention of Allah Almighty instead of the attention of people. If you are thinking you're that kind of person who, you know, have a strong urge to have the other people's attention, then you are doing something wrong in your life.
Exactly. You must just seek to gain his interest.
Exactly.
That's the only thing, with pure intention, of course.
Yeah.
So thank you for staying with us until another session. I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel bilateral relations that was formally signed off on the 21st of March 2023 included a reference to the UK-Israel tech hub that was established in 2011. The roadmap boasted that the hub had facilitated over 250 partnerships. One of those partnerships is with the Israeli tech company Cellebrite, which sells its technology to the British police and British security services. It's a curious arrangement because it seems Cellebrite may be able to access the information that the British security services and the British police obtain with Cellebrite's products. Latifa Abu Chakra has been investigating and has this report.
The phone and cloud hacking functions of the British security services are provided by a tech firm led by Israeli intelligence veterans who claim to control all products remotely. Cellebrite is an Israeli digital intelligence company largely based in the Zionist area of Petah Tikva, which was originally known as Mulabis by Palestinian inhabitants. Cellebrite is headed by Dan Agurna, a veteran of the infamous Israeli military intelligence unit 8200, which is known to blackmail Palestinians with information obtained through surveillance. Cellebrite is packed to the rafters with former Israeli military personnel at every level of the company. It is also 30% owned by Israeli growth partners. IGP was founded by Hiam Shani and Moshe Lichtman. Shani is the chairman of the UK-Israel Tech Hub, which uses British taxpayer money to obtain public contracts for Israeli tech companies. He was previously the Director General of the Israeli Finance Ministry and was awarded the honour of an OBE by the late Queen Elizabeth II for his work on the UK-Israel Tech Hub. Moshe Lichtman started as a programme manager at Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems. Cellebrite Technology delivers both phone and cloud hacking services for the British police. Palestine Declassified has found evidence that their software has been purchased by the British Foreign Office, which oversees MI6, the external intelligence agency of the British state. It also seems likely that data gathered by this technology is available to Cellebrite. As their CEO, Yossi Carmen, stated, "We control all the products remotely, activate the licenses remotely, and make sure they are in the right hands." The organization claims to have been involved in 2.5 million police investigations across the world in 1 year alone. However, it is not only the accused that are likely to come under their scope. Cellebrite promotes its cloud extraction product and explicitly encourages the surveillance of victims too, meaning that the personal information of victims of crime is fair game for this company. Should a company full of Israeli military and intelligence veterans be hacking phones and clouds for the British security services? When asked how he sleeps at night, the CEO of Cellebrite, Yossi Carmel, replied, "I sleep well at night because I know for whom I work and for whom I serve."
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Mick Napier is our guest expert today. Mick's a long-standing friend of the show and he's been a guest on several previous occasions. He's a lifelong anti-racist socialist and the secretary of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He's been a high-profile advocate for the Palestinian cause for many years and he's defeated the lawfare tactics by Zionist extremists that saw him certified free of racism, not just by one, but by two Scottish courts. We spoke to him earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, tell us about Cellebrite and its relationship with the British police and the British Foreign Office.
Well, this is a company which is an Israeli company and which has all its connections to Israeli military and intelligence, and which is being used by the police up and down the country, and indeed by the Foreign Office to use its technology. And its technology is involved in hacking and spying. And as we saw in the film, it has remote access. And you look at this and you think, is it really the case that MI5 and MI6 are so so bought into Zionist narratives that they can't see any potential national security problem with this. And it appears to be the case. I mean, this technology, this company, we've looked at many other companies like this in previous episodes, but this company seems to have all sorts of access, which, if it was going straight back to Tel Aviv and to Israeli intelligence, you would not want that to happen, either from the point of view of national security or from the point of view of the ordinary citizens of this country whose data may well end up on laptops over in occupied Palestine. Now, that surely cannot be in the public interest, in the interest of national security, or in anything which would be defined as the British national interest.
No, indeed. We certainly do seem to be coming across these examples on a startling regularity. But anyway, I started by asking Mick what his response was to the information contained in Latifa's report.
Well, it's pretty shocking, isn't it? I mean, clearly, London is subcontracting core state functions to the Israeli intelligence industry, the so-called security industry. I mean, Britain is doing this because it well understands that Israel are leaders in the field. An Israeli brigadier general, his name was El Kabetz, went to a security conference in the USA, in New Mexico, and he said at that conference that Gaza was a great laboratory for them, meaning that they were able to conduct intensive round-the-clock surveillance operations on a captive population and perfect the technology, which seems Britain is now quite happy to use. And obviously they're happy to use it against citizens, but there's no control whatsoever on how Israel will use the information which goes through that channel towards them. I mean, they're sitting at the centre of the operation and they'll use that information as they see fit.
So, David, what exactly is the UK-Israel Tech Hub and why is it relevant here?
UK-Israel Tech Hub is something funded by the British government. So it's British government money which is going into this, and it's run by this guy who's the CEO or the head of one of these firms, in fact, of several Israeli spy firms, it would appear. So this is a guy paid directly by the British government to facilitate Israeli tech companies to get contracts in the UK. Now, many of these tech companies are staffed with people who used to be in Unit 8200, which is the surveillance and spying agency of the Israeli government, the equivalent of GCHQ in the UK and the NSA. In the USA. So this is an extraordinary position of someone who used to work in an Israeli ministry being employed by the British government to facilitate the penetration of the UK economy and indeed of UK security by Israeli firms. I mean, it's truly extraordinary. And nobody in this country, of course, is writing about this.
No, indeed. Although there knows. Well, I then asked Mick about Cellebrite's claims to remotely control all of its devices, and whether that would pose a problem for British security, in his opinion.
You know, I think that they make that claim because of the terrible publicity they received when Israeli surveillance technology was used to murder the Saudi human rights campaigner in the embassy, I think it's the consulate in Istanbul. And therefore, this claim that they control everything is supposed to reassure us that it can't be used by supposed rogue elements like the Riyadh government, the Saudi government.
David, Cellebrite also has contracts with countries like Venezuela and Pakistan, and actually until recently, Russia as well. I mean, and all this was carried out via Singapore, wasn't it? I mean, could the security systems of those states be compromised, do you think?
Just by this company? Yes, of course. I mean, that's what the potential is. I mean, can we imagine that the Israelis would be having these companies stuffed with former intelligence agents and not make use of the data? Were they able to get hold of it? Would they be able to get hold of it, given that these are all ex-intelligence agents? Well, it seems perfectly obvious that's what would be the case. Are the Israelis regarded by, for example, the US as a hostile power in terms of counterintelligence? Well, yes, they are, according to the documents leaked, of course, by Edward Snowden, where the US intelligence community says, yes, it's an ally, but it's also a key an enemy in terms of, and a hostile power in terms of its intelligence capacity. So we know that that's the case.
Well, I also asked Mick if he thought this was an example of straightforward state capture.